You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. 2016 marks the 20th anniversary of Damon Hill's coronation as Formula One world champion. For the first time ever, in the book Watching the Wheels, my autobiography, Damon tells the story of his journey through the last golden era of the sport when he took on the greats including Ayrton Senna and Michael Schumacher and emerged victorious as world champion in 1996, stepping out of the shadow of his legendary father, Graham Hill. Delighted to be joining me on the line from the UK. 1996 Formula One world champion Damon Hill. Damon, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you, Josh.
It doesn't seem like 20 years ago, does it? It almost seems like, I mean, I always look at the stats like this and think it was about 5 years ago. It seems to have gone by in a blink of an eye.
It does, well, doesn't it? It's quite scary. Yeah, but it was, nevertheless, 20 years ago that I won the championship, and a lot's happened, a lot of water under the bridge, a lot of change, and so the book's about reflecting on how I came to become world champion, my dad, my parents, when I was growing up, and it's a proper full life story, bringing us right up to date.
I mean, you're the closest thing, if you like, we have, if you like, of British racing royalty. You grew up, obviously, your father was a world champion. He was part of that golden generation of British, great British drivers such as Jim Clark, John Surtees, Jackie Stewart. There's a very famous picture that I remember seeing of you being pushed around in the front garden by Jackie Stewart and your father. It must have been quite an interesting childhood, an unconventional childhood.
Obviously, it was unusual to have a dad who was racing in Formula One and won Indianapolis, as you say, and all those things, and being surrounded by other racing drivers. And I enjoyed a very exciting life, you know, also having my own ordinary upbringing, going to school and all the rest of it. But then it was punctuated by something that happened in 1975, where my dad, he started his own race team, and then he was flying back with the team from the south of France, and the plane crashed, and they were all killed, and then our life changed completely.
Yes, yeah, so the Embassy Hill team, of course, killed the driver as well, Tony Brise. It must have been, obviously, a tremendous personal shock for you. You were 15, 16 at the time?
I was 15, so, yeah, it was, you know, obviously, you know, blew that part, the family apart, and my mum was, you know, in shock from that, and we had a big change in our lives, and in some ways, I bottled it up, really, what happened there, and got on with my life and career and stuff, but it sort of seemed to come back to me later on after I'd stopped racing, and I had to go and talk to someone, have some therapy, and work out, you know, what was happening to me. But I think it was, so it's a legacy from that, and it's amazing that, you know, you just can't, you can't just walk away from things like that. And at the time, it was nothing like grief counselling or anyone to talk to. It was just something, everyone just moved on.
I mean, we're talking the mid-70s. He was one of the most charismatic, even now, people recognise the racing helmet from your father, the one that you wore yourself as well, which was, is it the Putney Rowing Club colours, isn't it, if I remember correctly?
London. They're in Putney. It's called the London Rowing Club, yeah, and he rowed, and that's how he met my mum. She rowed for England in European Games in about 1953. And won what would have been an Olympic gold medal. So she was a competitive rower. And then he loved rowing too, and they met down in through rowing, and he decided when he went racing to carry on using their colours. So it's a blue helmet with white stripes, which represent, you know, the oars. And I carried that on, a kind of heraldry, a hill emblem, if you like, and in my career. So there was two hills with this, you know, it's kind of a symbol, if you like, of the question I ask in the book, which is whether or not I was genuinely, authentically me doing what I wanted to do, or otherwise Graham Hill Part 2.
Mm.
You can't have another Graham Hill, that's for sure.
people would assume that if you're the son of a Formula One world champion, double Formula One world champion, your father winning in 62 and 68, if my memory serves me correctly, you're set for life. But it wasn't like that. I mean, you ended up being a motorcycle courier, didn't you, at one point in your life?
Yeah, I think it's a common misconception that once you've had success you no need to worry. I mean, everyone has to work, but in my dad's case, there was a financial catastrophe as well, because he'd extended himself to move up in the world and also to start his team, and the plane was found to have paperwork that wasn't right, and through some oversight, and so there was claims against the estate, and you know, my mum, we had to kind of go back to reduced circumstances, and I had to make my own way, which I had no problem with at all. I mean, I would have preferred that in a way, because I can always claim, you know, I didn't. He started with nothing, and he made his way to the top, and I did the same.
Because you started, didn't you, with motorcycle racing? That was your first love, wasn't it? The motorcycles.
Yeah, I wanted to race bikes. I mean, I did that because I loved it, and I was getting quite good at it. I got an opportunity to move over into cars, and I wasn't too keen at first, but it turned out that I was quite good, and it looked like I could have had a potential career at it. And then the kind of bug bit, and I didn't have a very auspicious start. In my first race, I didn't qualify, and I was at the back of the grid, and then I spun off. But I made that good later on in my career.
I mean, people sort of say it's a tough life getting into motorsport anyway, especially sort of these days. Some might say, oh, well, obviously your name was Hill, your father was, you know, much loved by, you know, was a world champion. But in another set of ways, it brings its own set of pressures, because if you put on the helmet and strap yourself into a racing car, and no matter what formula, people are expecting you to consider to carry on the Hill lineage.
Yeah, and that's really the whole issue in the book, is this business of, well, what bit do I claim for myself, and what bit is... It's a legacy that he left us as a family, and me, particularly as a driver, and how you distinguish yourself. I mean, most people today watching, well, a lot of people who watch F1 today probably wouldn't even remember Graham Hill. They know the history of the sport. They probably wouldn't even remember me. But so it goes back quite a long way. But at the time, I mean, the reason Murray Walker said when I won the championship, you know, and I've got to stop because I've got a lump in my throat. So that was, I'm sure, largely to do with everyone knowing my story and my dad's story, and then knowing the story of his accident and stuff. It was a kind of phoenix rising from the ashes moment.
I mean, you got your first drive. Was it in F1? Was it with Brabham? I remember something at the British Grand Prix in a Brabham, and Mansell overtook you. It must have been about 91, 92. And they said, you know, here is our world champion, Murray, again, and here's a future world champion. And at that point, when you entered Formula 1, did you think, right, I've got it in me to be the world champion, or are you just happy to be there and amazed to be there in an F1 car?
No, every driver worth their salt, you know, they go into it to be at the front. They don't go into it just to be there. I mean, some drivers do, and you know, you can tell they're just quite happy to be Formula 1 drivers, and that's not good enough. I mean, it is about being at the front. It can be no satisfaction in just tooling around in midfield. So it was very perceptive of Murray to say that, because I was five laps down and didn't look particularly like a world champion then. But I was at the time test driver for Nigel at Williams, so I was getting my hands on the same equipment, and I knew that if I got that in a race situation, I could be up there at the front too.
And, of course, Nigel surprised everybody by going off to IndyCar, having won his world championship, and you found yourself in a drive at Williams, is that correct?
Yeah, very much like the situation I found myself in years later when I'd won the championship and I didn't have a drive. Nigel actually took the decision to move out and leave a hole, which gave me my opportunity. So I owe Nigel an enormous debt of gratitude for going when he did, through Indy,
right,
and I sort of was sucked into that vortex.
1994 was a momentous year in motorsport in more ways than one. You find yourself in a Williams and being joined by the legend Ayrton Senna. What was it like when it was revealed that Ayrton Senna was going to be your teammate, and obviously being Ayrton, he was going to be very much number one?
It was a big surprise when they announced that, but I thought, this is fantastic. You know, I've been teammates where I've been test driver with Nigel, I was teammates with Alan Prost, and now I've got Ayrton Senna. So being in a team like Williams, you're at the sharp end, you know, you rub shoulders with the very best drivers, and so the start of the season was all looking like it was going to be, and I was going to learn a lot, and that I'd be able to get a chance to see how I compare to this great driver. But as we know, sadly, what happened at Imola in 94, there were two drivers who were killed, and one of them was Ayrton.
Ratzenberger being killed on the day before. But what was Ayrton like? You know, on the first couple of days, you know, when you're doing your testing in Owen Anglesey, wherever you were, and he gets in the car.
I don't remember Anglesey, but yeah, Estoril.
Right, Estoril. Sorry, yeah,
Estoril. He was a huge star. You know, he was immensely charismatic and carried this import, this kind of presence that he had around, and all the attention was very much on the Ayrton Senna. But he was perfectly fine to me, you know. But he made it clear that you know, he wasn't going out. He was there to do his job and win a championship, another world championship in the Williams.
And you probably thought, if I'm going to set myself up, you know, to be a number one driver in the future, there's no better benchmark than the best driver in the world, I would imagine.
No, completely. I mean, if you could ever get close to him and compete, then you'd have made your mark as really one of the hottest drivers around. Someone like Mika Häkkinen qualified him and raced against him, but he was formidable as a competitor. There's no doubt about it.
It came to the weekend of the San Marino Grand Prix at Imola. It's been described as the weekend that God took his hand away from motorsport. Ratzenberger is killed. Well, Rubens has a huge crash on Friday, I think it was. Saturday, Ratzenberger is killed. The first driver killed in a Grand Prix for a very, very long time. And then Ayrton is killed in the actual race itself. What can you remember about that weekend? I know it's obviously there's a lot of emotions going through, but what can you remember of the actual weekend itself?
Well, I go through as much as I can remember, as much as I knew about what happened in the book, and I try to explain my feelings about the situation and what I understood it to be. And I could describe it as a perfect storm, whereby there was lots of people were trying to find one reason why those accidents happened, and why did Ayrton die? I don't think there was one reason. I think that there was a number of factors that conspired to make something happen, and it was really bad luck that he was struck by a part of the suspension as well that ultimately was fatal. But that could have happened at any speed, and the challenge was that in the race itself there was a number of things that led up to it, not least because he hadn't scored a point yet, they'd restarted the race and he'd been complaining about the safety car, and then there was a safety car in the race, and the tyre pressures were a factor. Any number of things you want to talk about, I'd examine in the book, and together with his state of mind after Roman Ratzenberger and before that in his own personal life. So I'm not sure that he was completely clear in his mind about what he was doing, and I think he may have pushed just a little bit too hard, and that's why he went off. But I personally don't believe that the steering column, which they claim was the cause of the accident, I can't believe that actually happened. Looking at all the data,
Ayrton was killed. The world goes into shock because he was the best known racing driver on the planet. How do you then try and pick yourself up and the team up? How does the team react to this new guy, this legend who's only been in the car? Well, this was the fourth race I think he'd been racing with Williams. I mean, how did you muster yourself and muster the team to go forward and go to Monaco and get a result?
It was difficult for everyone, because carrying on without really knowing why you're doing this. You don't want to carry on if the sport is disregarding those people who become victims of the sport. You don't want to have a sport like that. So the sport had to look at what it was about and whether or not things could be done. And the sport changed enormously after Imola, and looking at safety, much more safety protection for the driver's head. So good things came out of it, but it was at the cost of the loss of two drivers' lives. Mm. But it had to change, and it took something like that to make that change happen.
Let's move on from 94, because then you get involved in subsequent years with one of the greatest sort of on-track rivalries I think we've seen for a very, very long time, Mr. Schumacher. Michael and you had a real ding-dong battle in the mid-90s, including the famous Australian Grand Prix, where he went off and shouldn't have come back on and ran to you, and I will always have that opinion. I mean, it must have been, you're now at number one in Williams, and it was an exciting time and a great time for you to come forth as your own man.
Yeah, but it was always... the season was a product of what happened at Imola. So the battle between me and Michael in 94 became a battle of wanting to fight for the kind of the ghost of Ayrton, the feeling that he somehow should have been there race against Mike, and I received I was given a football a shirt signed by all the Brazilian football team as kind of a goodwill, a good luck kind of message from them, and it was very emotional for me to be supported by those who saw Ayrton as being still kind of involved in this battle against Michael Schumacher. I think Michael was perhaps unfairly seen as the villain in the part, you know, but he, you know, he did have his own particular way of going about sport, and in some ways he encouraged that view.
You've got through that season. You're now into the other seasons, 2000 and 2005 and 1995. Sorry, that shows the age. And 1996. And 1996 is your world championship year. The lead up to that must have been, you know, as you're rattling off the wins. You know, you're winning the British Grand Prix, for example. A tremendous feeling and a feeling of building towards. Suzuka was the fight with the race where you clinched the championship, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Again, so Suzuka was very important for me twice. You know, I had the race against Michael Schumacher in 94, which I had to win to keep the championship alive, and then there was the place where I became world champion. So it wasn't decided until we went to Japan. So if you add Adelaide into that, I managed to get everyone out of bed three times on the trot, and at very early time, about 3 a.m. So I'm very grateful for all the support. I mean, they had every right to be upset with me, really.
What goes through your mind, though, going into that fast Suzuka? Suzuka, a technically ferocious track, one of the best tracks on the calendar. The weather wasn't great either. You must have had some real heart-in-mouth moments, knowing that this is your chance. You know, you may not get this chance again. You're going to become the first driver to follow his father's footsteps and become a world champion. I mean, the conflicting emotions must have been massive.
Well, if you think it's your last chance, and I'd already been told I wasn't going to be driving for the team the following year, so I thought, you know, I knew this was probably my one and only chance to break through, and so I just had to accept that. You know, I had to look at whether or not I'd done all the preparation, and I could actually look at myself in the mirror and say, well, I've tried everything I possibly can to be prepared for this race, and come what may, you know, and this is going to be the day where you'll find out. So it was quite a tense moment, but an exhilarating moment. What you live for as a sports person, you know, you want to be there. You want the day to finally arrive when you're going to be put to the test. And very luckily for me, it turned out good.
And as we said, Murray had to stop because he had a lump in his throat. What was going through your mind when you crossed the line and you're on the slowdown lap knowing that you've become the 1996 world champion?
Well, the peculiar thing was that Jacques Villeneuve was out of the race, so I knew before the race had finished that I'd become world champion. And so I just had to keep going because we were still in a race to beat Michael in the actual race itself. So my wife was celebrating about 20 laps before I actually joined her. So she was quite sozzled by the time I
Fantastic. You went on to making a surprise, one of the most surprising moves, you could say, in one of the histories of Grand Prix, going to Arrows. And you very, very nearly won with Arrows Hungary. I was watching live. It was perhaps the closest, I mean, shouting at the TV moments on my behalf. Yeah. And you must have been screaming into your helmet as well as Jacques passed you with two laps to go, three laps to go?
Yeah, I mean, I've had some things happened in my career that just made some interesting experiences, and going to Arrows was not seen as a very smart move, but I needed to find a team that would have me for just 1 year, so I ended up there. I hadn't got very much choice anyway, and in the Hungary race we didn't think, you know, I just thought we had a fantastic qualifying, and I thought after 20 laps, I thought this has been great, this is a great weekend, and if it stops now then we can go home happy, we've had some fun. But the car kept going and going, and it got towards the end of the race, one lap from the end, and then it decided to have a problem, which meant I could limp home. But I thought I'll try and stop Jacques Villeneuve coming past me by weaving a bit. And he kept his foot in. He didn't have to, but he kept his foot in and ended up on the grass. But I would have got into serious trouble if I'd taken him off. So thankfully that didn't happen. But I came second, which was better than expected anyway.
And then later on, you went to perhaps one of the most fun teams on the planet, Jordan, and you got them the first win at a memorable weekend in Spa.
It was absolutely horrendous conditions. You know, there was a massive shunt at the start, and my teammate was breathing down my neck, and we had some discussion on the radio with team orders.
A certain Schumacher, a certain Ralph Schumacher, if I believe.
It was, his brother, Ralph.
Who was busy having a ruck with David Coulthard in the pits at the time, I think.
Yeah, that's right. There was Michael had, because he ran into the back of David. Yeah, there was a pretty dramatic race all round. And we won. So Eddie was delighted. You can imagine he was dancing a jig and behaving like even more of a maniac than he is, naturally.
But, Arab, I mean, Jordan must have been a fun team to drive for. I remember you actually led the British Grand Prix for a couple of laps as well, and the whole crowd went mad as you came around Woodcote. I remember that very, very well indeed. You retired from F1, and you went into you ended up being president of the BRDC, and, of course, we now know you as well from your television work. Looking back, you know, your son is now taking the first steps into motor racing. Isn't there that sort of feeling of, oh, I've been there, I've done this, you know, wouldn't a career in investment banking be safer?
Well, he actually has been through the whole process and decided he didn't want to carry on. So he's now left motorsport and he's gone into music. So he's drumming for a band called The Severs and doing very well. And they're constantly looking for gigs. But he's moved on from motor racing. And so this is the crux of the issue, you know, about my life. And, you know, would I have carried on racing if my dad had lived? As you know, we got to find the thing we love doing, and he's found what he loves doing, and he didn't love motor racing enough to want to carry on doing it.
Mm. When you came to write the book then on this 20th anniversary, I mean, did you just literally go away for a while and sit down? Did you make notes through the way? And it sounds like it was, you know, you were facing, or faced real periods of introspection since then.
Yeah, no, I've had a big period of introspection because I did have therapy and stuff because I had depression. So I a lot of that is involved in going back to your childhood. Famously, kind of the cliche is, you know, tell us about your childhood, and you talk about your parents and that, and you kind of evolve a picture which you have faith in about your life, you know, not the myth, not the thing you're told, and it's what you feel in your guts to be true about things. And then I didn't keep a diary when I was racing, but I didn't need to. There's so many people who write about the sport and take photographs. I know, you know, I was pouring through the internet and getting all the history, and I could check my facts. And I had Maurice Hamilton with me, who was there through my career and is a great sports writer. And he was able to, you know, remind me of bits I'd forgotten that people want to know about, because a lot of it is from your own perspective, is not necessarily what people were interested in. And so I was able to compare notes.
And do you think, you know, coming back to the book, I mean, the book sounds very introspective about you sort of finding yourself, if you like. It sounds like more of a book that, okay, will interest the motor racing petrol head, F1 nut, of which there are legions, but also something a little bit more that those who want to look back and find out a little bit about, you know, the man himself.
Well, hopefully it's relevant to all of us. You know, I think it's about... it's about all of us, everyone at some stage or other goes, well, where am I going with my life, and what am I doing, and what am I here for, and finding out what's important. And so there's definitely there's all sorts of angles in there. I think some of the stuff I've written about may not be of interest to motor racing fans, and vice versa. But it's my whole life in a book. Not everything, you can't get it all in, but you know, it's as much as I can put in a book, and hopefully all the good bits and the bits that make you laugh, make you cry, kind of thing.
It's been 20 years since you won the World Championship. Any particular moment stand out that makes you think, you know, that was it, that was why I did it, and that's the moment, that, you know, that's the memory that I carry even now? I mean, it could be a bad tyre stop somewhere, or just winning the thing.
Probably two, I suppose. Winning the British Grand Prix is one, and then winning the World Championship. So you can't do, you know, for a British driver, that's reaching the pinnacle.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you. The book's called Watching the Wheels, My Autobiography, by Damon Hill. It's out in Buckmillan Main Market on the 8th of September. Damon Hill, 1996 World Champion, it's been a pleasure speaking to you.
It's been a pleasure being talked to you. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you very much.